Meg knew of no one Ted might know at Oregon State University. No, there had never been any pornography in his room. No, he didn't own a sailboat, but he had rented one once. Ted often liked to search out lonely country roads when they went on drives. Did he ever go to taverns alone?
Only O'Banion's and Dante's.
Meg consulted her diary. There were so many dates to remember.
Ted called me from Salt Lake City on October 18th last year, 3 times. He was going hunting with my father the next morning. He called me on November 8th after 11 o'clock.
Salt Lake City time zone would make it after midnight there.
There was a lot of noise in the background when he called.
Melissa Smith vanished on October 18th. On November 8th, Carol DeRanche was abducted at 7:30, and Debbie Kent vanished forever at 10:30. Recalling July 1974, Meg remembered that Ted had gone to Lake Sammamish State Park on July 7th, the week before Denise and Janice disappeared.
He told me he was invited to a water skiing party. When he came over later, he said he hadn't had a very good time.
In fact, there had been no party, although the King County detectives learned later that two couples who knew Ted from Republican Party functions had been at Lake Sammamish water skiing, and they'd seen Ted walking along the beach alone.
We were surprised to see him there because he was supposed to be at a political meeting at Tacoma that weekend.
Asked what he was doing, Ted had responded, "Just walking around." They had invited him to join them skiing, but he'd demurred because he had no shorts with him. Ted had had a windbreaker slung around his shoulders. They had seen no cast. On the next Sunday, the 14th, Meg, of course, had seen Ted only early in the morning, and then again sometime after 6 when he came to her home to exchange the ski rack and to take her out for hamburgers.
"My mother always keeps a diary," Meg said. "My folks came up to visit me on May 23rd, 1974. On Memorial Day, the 27th, Ted went with us for a picnic on Dungeness Spit."
"What about May 31st? Kathy McChesney asked. That was the night Brenda Ball had vanished from the Flame Tavern.
"That was the night before my daughter was to be baptized. My parents were still in Seattle, and Ted took us all out for pizza and then dropped us off before 9.
Brenda had disappeared sometime after 2 a.m., 12 miles south of Meg's apartment, 5 hours later. Leanne had been baptized at 5 p.m. the next day, and Ted had arrived to attend the ceremony. Afterward, he stayed at Meg's place until 11 p.m.
"He was very tired, and he fell asleep on the rug that night, too," she told McChesney.
Meg furnished the name of a woman that Ted had dated during the summer of 1972, a woman who had caused her to break up with her lover briefly. This woman, Claire Forrest, was slender, brunette, and her long, straight hair parted in the middle. When she was contacted by detectives, Claire Forrest remembered Ted well. Although she had never been seriously interested in him, she said, they had dated often in 1972.
"He didn't feel that he fit in with my class. I guess that's the only way to describe it. He wouldn't come to my parents' home because he said he just didn't fit in."
Claire recalled that she had once taken a drive with Ted, a drive over country roads in the Lake Sammamish area.
"He told me that someone, an older woman, I think he said his grandmother, lived around there, but he couldn't find the house. I finally got fed up with it and asked him what the address was, but he didn't know."
Ted, of course, had no grandmother near Lake Sammamish. Claire Forrest said that she had had intercourse with Bundy on only one occasion, and although he had always been tender and affectionate with her before, that sex act itself had been harsh.
"We went on a picnic in April on the Hump Tulips River, and I had quite a lot of wine. I was dizzy, and he kept dunking my head under. He was trying to untie the top of my bikini. He couldn't manage it, and he suddenly pulled my bikini bottom off and had intercourse with me. He didn't say anything, and he had his forearm pressed under my chin so hard that I couldn't breathe. I kept telling him I couldn't breathe, but he didn't let up the pressure until he was finished. There was no affection at all. Afterward, it was like it had never happened. We drove home and he talked about his family, everyone but his father. I broke up with him because of his other girlfriend. She was almost hysterical when she found me with him once."
Claire Forrest was not the only woman who would recall that Ted Bundy's manner could change suddenly from one of warmth and affection to cold fury. On June 23, 1974, Ted had shown up at the home of a woman who had known him on a platonic basis since 1973. She introduced him to a friend of hers, Lisa Temple. Ted didn't seem particularly interested in Lisa,
but later he invited the two women and another male friend to go on a raft trip with him on June 29th. The two couples had dinner with friends in Bellevue on June 28th, spent the night, and set out the next morning for Thorpe, Washington. The man who accompanied them was later to recall that while searching for matches, he had found a pair of pantyhose in the glove box of Ted's Volkswagen. He had grinned and thought nothing of it. The raft trip had started out with great hilarity, but halfway down the river, Ted's attitude had changed suddenly, and he seemed to delight in tormenting Lisa. He insisted that she ride through the whitewater on an inner tube tied behind the raft. Lisa had been terrified, but Ted had only stared at her coldly. The other couple were ill at ease, too. Ted had put the raft into the water at Diversion Dam, a dangerous stretch where rafts were rarely launched. They had made it, finally, through the rough water with both girls thoroughly frightened. Ted had had no money, so Lisa bought dinner in North Bend for the quartet. "He drove me home," she remembers, "and he was nice again. He said he would be back about midnight. He did come back, and we made love. That's the last time I ever saw him. I just couldn't understand the way he kept changing. One minute he was nice, and the next he acted like he hated me." Kathy McChesney located Beatrice Sloan, the elderly woman who'd befriended Ted when he worked at a Seattle yacht club. "Oh, he was a schemer," the old woman recalled. "He could talk me out of anything." Mrs. Sloan's recollections of Ted and Stephanie corresponded with what Kathy had already learned about that early romance. There was no question that the woman had known Ted, and known him quite well. Kathy drove her around the university district, and she pointed out addresses where Ted had lived when she knew him. She recounted the things she'd loaned him, the china, silver, money. She recalled rides she'd given him when he had no car. He seemed to have been like a grandson to her, a highly manipulative grandson. "When was the last time you saw him?" McChesney asked. "Well, I saw him twice, actually, in 1974. I saw him in the Albertson store at Green Lake in July, and he had a broken arm then. Then I saw him on the Ave about a month later, and he told me he was leaving soon to go to law school in Salt Lake City." The King County detectives contacted Stephanie Brooks, happily married now and living in California. She recalled her two romances with Ted Bundy, their college days and their engagement in 1973. She had never known about Meg Anders. She had simply come to the conclusion that Ted had courted her a second time solely to get revenge. She felt lucky to be free of him. There seemed to be two Ted Bundys emerging. One, the perfect son, the University of Washington student who had graduated with distinction, the fledgling lawyer and politician, and the other, a charming schemer, a man who could manipulate women with ease, whether it be sex or money he desired, and it made no difference if the women were 18 or 65. And there was, perhaps, a third Ted Bundy, a man who turned cold and hostile toward women with very little provocation. He had juggled his concurrent engagements with Meg and Stephanie so skillfully that neither of them knew of the other's existence. Now it seemed that he had lost them both. Stephanie was married, and Meg declared that she no longer wanted to marry Ted. She was deathly afraid of him. Yet within a matter of weeks, she would take him back and blame herself for ever doubting him. As far as women went, Ted always had a backup. Even as he sat in the Salt Lake County Jail, unaware that Meg had talked volubly about him to detectives, he had the emotional support of Sharon Auer. Sharon seemed to have fallen in love with him. "I would soon realize that it was not prudent to mention Sharon's name to Meg, or to speak of Meg to Sharon." It is interesting to note that through all the trials, through all the years of black headlines that would label Ted a monster and worse, he would always have at least one woman entranced with him, living for the few moments she could visit him in jail, running errands, proclaiming his innocence. The women would change as time passed. Apparently, the emotions he provoked in them would not. Chapter 19. Ted had his detractors as he languished in jail in Salt Lake City during the fall of 1975, but he had his staunch supporters, too. One of them was Alan Scott, the cousin he'd grown up with since he'd moved to Tacoma when he was 4 years old. Scott,
himself a teacher of disturbed youngsters, insisted that he had never detected the slightest signs of deviant behavior in Ted. He, his sister Jane, and Ted had always been close, closer than Ted had ever been with his half-brothers and sisters. His cousins were not Bundys, and Ted had never really felt part of the Bundy clan. It is ironic, then, that Jane and Alan Scott would prove to be further links in the chain of circumstantial evidence tying Ted with the missing Washington girls. They did not do so willingly. Indeed, they believed in his innocence completely. They worked to solicit funds for Ted's defense, and many of his old friends contributed. Dr. Patricia Lunneborg of the psychology department at the University of Washington stated flatly that Ted Bundy could not possibly be a killer, and said that there was absolutely no reason to believe that he had ever known Linda Ann Healy, despite the fact that they had both taken abnormal psychology, Psych 499, in the winter and spring quarters of 1972. "There are hundreds of students in many different sections of 499," she said scornfully. "There's no way to prove they were in the same sections." Lunneborg said she intended to do everything she could to support Bundy against the ridiculous charges and innuendos about him. But there was another link between Bundy and Linda Ann Healy, and that link was through his cousin Jane. When Linda had lived in McMahon Hall, her roommate was the woman who would later be Jane Scott's roommate. Detective Bob Keppel located Jane on a fishing boat in Alaska and interviewed her in a phone call to Dutch Harbor. Jane was not a willing witness. She, too, said her cousin had been normal, kind, not the kind of boy or man who would kill. She had seen him, she said, three or four times during the first half of 1974. Jane had met Linda Healy. She could never recall that Ted had. Yes, there had been some parties over the years, but she didn't know for sure Ted had ever attended the same parties that Linda had.
"Did you ever speak of Linda's disappearance to Ted?" Keppel asked.
"Yes," she said reluctantly, "but I can't remember anything specific. We just talked about what a terrible thing it was." Alan Scott was even less cooperative, an understandable position. Alan had lived at Freda Rogers' home from September 1971 to February 1972. He and Ted had remained in close contact, and Alan had talked to Ted within days of the disappearances of Roberta Parks, Brenda Ball, Georgianne Hawkins, Denise Naslund, and Janice Ott.
"He was relaxed, happy, excited about going to law school in Utah, and looking forward to marrying Meg."
Scott didn't add that a man who had abducted and killed young women couldn't have acted so calm, but that was his implication. Scott had gone sailing with his cousin on Lake Washington, and they often hiked together.
"Where?"
Keppel asked.
"In the Carbonado area and off Highway 18 near North Bend."
Taylor Mountain, the resting place of four of the Washington victims' skulls, was off Highway 18 near North Bend. Keppel said quietly,
"When did you hike up there?"
"July 1972 through the summer of 1973.
Scott did not want to show the King County detectives just where they had hiked. He was reluctant to incriminate his cousin, and in the end, it would take the threat of a subpoena to make him lead them over the trails that had become familiar to Bundy. On November 26, 1975, a subpoena was served on Alan Scott, and he accompanied Bob Keppel to the area where he had hiked with Ted. They drove toward Taylor Mountain, and Scott pointed out rough fields and woods along the Fall City Duval Road, the Issaquah-Hobart Road.
"Ted knew the roads around here, and we drove around in my car looking at old farms and barns. There was one place with a great footbridge along the Fall City-Preston Road. That's the only time we really got out and hiked."
He pointed out the road 3/4 of a mile north of Preston.
"We hiked about 2 hours up the hillside."
The area was only a few miles from Taylor Mountain. Apparently, the region between Issaquah and North Bend had been a favorite haunt of Ted's. He had driven Meg there and Claire Forrest, mentioned it to his elderly woman friend, and taken his cousin there. He had gone to Lake Sammamish State Park alone only a week before July 14th. Was it merely coincidence, or was it meaningful to the investigation? Contrary to published reports, there were some eyewitness identifications of Ted Bundy. One witness was contaminated, however, by the zeal of a newswoman. When Ted was arrested in the Durant kidnapping case, The television reporter rushed to the home of one of the women who had been approached by the stranger at Lake Sammamish on July 14th. The anchor woman held out a photo of Ted Bundy and asked, "Is this the man who asked you to help him?" The woman could not identify him. The man in the picture shown to her looked older than the handsome tanned man she had seen. When King County detectives later showed her a mug laydown of 8 pictures, including one of Ted Bundy, she admitted that it was too late. She had already been shown a picture, and now she was confused. It was a major blow to the investigation. The tearing hurry of the news media to show Ted to the public continued to get in the way of the probe. Two other women who had seen the Ted at the park recognized him at once, but they recognized him from the pictures they saw in the paper and on television. They were convinced that Ted Bundy and the other Ted were one and the same, but any defense lawyer would contend that they had been subconsciously swayed by glimpsing Ted's picture in the media. A male witness who was present at Lake Sammamish on July 14th was out of the state when the news of the Utah arrest broke, and he'd seen no pictures of Ted at all. Yet he picked Ted Bundy's picture from a mug laydown without hesitation. So did the Oregon District Attorney's son, who had been in Ellensburg on April 17th when Susan Rancourt vanished. He was 70% sure, far from being as valuable in court as 100% would have been. "I drove back to Seattle from Ellensburg late that night," he recalled. "When I was about 10 miles east of Issaquah, I noticed a small foreign car pulled off on a side road. The taillights were small and round, like a VW's." The spot he mentioned was close to Taylor Mountain. Another tiny link? For a fiction writer, it would have been enough. For an actual criminal investigation, it was circumstantial evidence, block upon block piled up until there was no doubt in the Washington detectives' minds that Theodore Robert Bundy was the Ted they had sought for so long. But enough to bring charges? No. They didn't have so much as a single hair, a button or an earring, nothing that locked Ted Bundy tightly to any of the victims. No prosecutor in his right mind would touch it. They would count over 40 coincidences, and even taken all together, it wasn't enough. The final coincidence was a case that Seattle Morals Detective Joyce Johnson had investigated, a rape case that occurred on March 2, 1974, at 4220 12th Avenue NE, only a few houses from Freda Rogers' rooming house. The victim, an attractive 20-year-old woman, had gone to bed around 1 a.m. on that Saturday morning. "My shades were drawn, and there's a place where one of the curtains doesn't meet the sill, and someone could look in and see that I was alone. About 3/4 of the time, I have someone with me. That morning, I'd forgotten to put the wooden slat in the window to lock it. The man took off the screen, and when I woke up about 4, I saw him standing in the doorway. I saw his profile. There was a light shining through from the living room where he'd left his flashlight on. He came over and sat on my bed and told me to relax, that he wouldn't hurt me." The woman had asked him how he'd gotten in, and he answered, "It is none of your business." The man had worn a t-shirt, jeans, and had a dark navy watch cap pulled over his face to below his chin. "It wasn't a ski mask, but I think he had made slits in it for his eyes because he could see. His voice was well educated. He'd been drinking. I could smell it. He had a knife with a carved handle, but he said he wouldn't use it if I didn't fight." The man had taped her eyes, and then he had raped her. She didn't fight him. When he was finished, he taped her hands and feet, telling her it was just to slow her down. She heard him go into the living room and crawl through a window, then the sound of footsteps running toward the alley. She heard no car. She told Detective Johnson, "He was so calm and sure of himself. I think he's done it before." The Seattle police detectives and Captain Nick Mackey and his detectives, Bob Keppel, Roger Dunn, Kathy McChesney, were convinced that they had found Ted. They listed the tie-ins in the missing girls' cases. Ted Bundy matched the physical description, so much so that 4 people had connected him to the composite drawing of the man seen at Lake Sammamish. He often wore white tennis outfits. He had lived within a mile of Linda Ann Healy, Georgianne Hawkins, and Joni Lenz. He drove a light tan Volkswagen. He often affected a British accent. He played racquetball. He had had a knife, a cleaver, a taped wrench, a crowbar, a hatchet, crutches, plaster of Paris, surgical gloves, and unexplained women's clothing in his possession. His whereabouts on the vital days could not be accounted for.
He had missed work for 3 days before and 2 days after the Lake Sammamish disappearances. He regularly traveled I-5 between Seattle and Olympia. He had a friend on the Evergreen State campus, often stayed with him. He had a friend in Ellensburg, a friend who recalled Ted's visiting in the spring of 1974. He'd had pantyhose in the glove compartment of his car. His cousin knew Linda Healy. He had taken the same classes Linda had. He'd been seen at Lake Sammamish State Park a week before Janice and Denise vanished. He had hiked in the Taylor Mountain area. He liked to sneak up behind women. He liked to frighten women. He preferred women with long dark hair parted in the middle. He had tried to choke at least two women while making love to them. He frequented Dante's Tavern, the tavern Linda had gone to the night she vanished. His manner toward women would change in an instant, from tenderness to hostility. He often wore a false mustache. He liked to sail, had rented sailboats. In the Colorado cases, his credit cards had been used in the same areas and towns on the same days the women vanished. He had lied and he had stolen. He appeared to be fascinated with bondage and sodomy. He'd been arrested with a ski mask, pantyhose mask, handcuffs, gloves, garbage bags, strips of cloth, and a crowbar in his possession. He'd reported his license plates missing in Utah, but kept them and used them interchangeably with the new plates issued to him. His blood type was O, the type found on kidnapped victim Carol Durant's coat. He'd been identified by Durant, Graham, Beck, the young man in Ellensburg, and by three witnesses at Lake Sammamish State Park on July 14th. He'd been seen by his elderly benefactress in July 1974 with his arm in a cast. During 1974, he'd slept during the days and was gone somewhere late at nights. A woman was raped by a man answering his description only 3 doors from the Rogers' rooming house. One of his high school friends was acquainted with Georgiane Hawkins' family. He was intelligent, charming, and could approach women easily and successfully. He habitually wore corduroy trousers, the ribbed pattern and the blood of Linda Healy's bed. The list went on, and the investigators always came back to the fact that wherever Ted Bundy went, there was soon a lovely young woman or two or three missing. On the other hand, there were dozens of people who were willing to swear that Ted Bundy was a perfect citizen. A man who worked to wipe out violence, to bring about order and peace through the system. That Ted Bundy was a lover, not a destroyer of mankind. If he was what detectives believed, a mass killer, he had been cast from an entirely new mold. On November 13, 1975, while Ted remained in the Salt Lake County Jail and his friends and relatives sought to raise the $15,000 needed to bail him out, what came to be known as the Aspen Summit meeting was held. Mackie, Keppel, and Dunn were there, Jerry Thompson and Ira Beale from Utah, Mike Fisher from Aspen, and dozens of other detectives who had unsolved cases of missing and murdered girls. Inside the Holiday Inn, the details of all those investigations were exchanged, and the name Theodore Robert Bundy was heard often. A tremendous amount of information was exchanged, only making each department involved more certain that they now had their killer in jail. In jail, but with not enough physical evidence to bring further charges. Newspapers were full of suppositions, but few facts. If the mysterious unknown Ted had frustrated them before, the known Ted Bundy still eluded them. On November 20th, Ted was freed on bail, $15,000 raised by Johnny and Louise Bundy. When and if he returned to face trial on the kidnapping charges involving Carol Durant, that money would be returned and then given to John O'Connell to pay for Ted's defense. In Seattle, Meg Anders was so frightened of her ex-lover that she made detectives promise that she be notified the minute he crossed into the state of Washington. It is indicative of his persuasive powers to note that within a day or so of his return to Washington, he was back with her, living in her apartment. All her doubts had been erased, and she was completely in love with him again. She did not deny published reports that they were engaged to be married. She berated herself for having betrayed him and would for years stand by him. Ted was free, but not truly free. Wherever he went, he was under constant surveillance by officers recruited from both the King County and Seattle police departments.
Mackey explained it to me.
We can't charge him, but we can't risk letting him out of our sight. If anything should happen while he's up here, if another girl should disappear, there'd be hell to pay.
And so, from the moment Ted's plane landed at Seattle-Tacoma Airport, he was tailed. He seemed at first to ignore the sneaker cars that followed him as he spent his days with Meg and her daughter, or stayed in a friend's apartment. I didn't know if I'd hear from Ted when he was in Seattle, but several detectives took me aside and said, "If he calls you, we don't want you going anywhere alone with him. Not unless you tell us where you're going to be first."
"Oh, come on," I said. "I'm not afraid of Ted. Besides, you're following him every place anyway. If I'm with him, you'll see me."
"Just be careful," a Seattle homicide detective warned. "Maybe we'd better know where to find your dental records in case we need to identify you."
I laughed, but the words were jarring. The black humor that would surround Ted Bundy evermore had begun. Chapter 20. Ted called me shortly after Thanksgiving, and we made arrangements to meet for lunch at the Brasserie Pittsburgh, a French restaurant in the basement of an old building in Pioneer Square, a restaurant only 2 blocks from both the Seattle and King County Police headquarters. I hadn't seen him for 2 years, yet he seemed hardly changed, except that his beard was fuller. He was a little thinner, perhaps, I thought, as he walked toward me through the rain, grinning. He wore corduroy slacks, a beige and brown coat sweater. It was strange. His picture had been on the front page of Seattle's papers so often that he should have been easily recognizable, but no one even glanced at him as we spent 3 hours together. With all the sightings there had been of the phantom Ted, no one noticed this real Ted at all. We stood in line, ordered the daily special, a carafe of Chablis, and I paid for it.
"When this is all over," he promised, "I'll take you out to lunch."
We carried our plates into the back room and sat at one of the old tables with its butcher paper cloth. It was good to see him, good to know that he was out of the jail that he'd hated so. It was almost as if nothing had happened at all. I knew that he was a prime suspect, but that was all I knew at the time. I had no knowledge at all beyond the few innuendos I'd read in the papers. Now it didn't seem that any of the charges could be possible. I didn't know that Meg had told detectives so much, didn't know a single detail of the day and night investigations that had gone on since August. I was a little nervous, and I glanced around, half expecting to see several detectives I would recognize sitting at other tables. In fact, I had had lunch with Nick Mackey and Dr. Berberick at the same restaurant a few weeks before, and the Brasserie Pittsburgh was a popular eating spot for detectives. The food was excellent, and it was convenient. "I wouldn't be surprised to see Mackey here," I told Ted. "He eats here about 3 days a week. He wants to talk to you. Maybe you should do it. He's not a bad guy."
"I have nothing to talk to him about. I'm sure he's a nice enough guy, but there's no point in our meeting. If they were alert, they could have seen me yesterday. I walked right through the first floor of the courthouse, right by their offices, and nobody spotted me."
The surveillance had become a game to him. He found the men tailing him clumsy and awkward and was taking delight in losing them.
"A few turns down alleys, around a few corners, and they can't find me. Or sometimes I go back and talk to them, and that really throws them. What do they expect? I've got nothing to hide."
He took particular pride in having lost Roger Dunn in the library at the University of Washington.
"I went in the front door of the men's room and out the back. He didn't know there was another door. For all I know, he's still standing out there waiting for me to come out."
He was not amused, however, at the prevailing attitude about his guilt in the minds of the public. He was particularly incensed because he had planned an afternoon of fun for Meg's 12-year-old daughter and the girl's best friend. "Her mother wouldn't even let her child go to a hamburger stand with me. It's ridiculous. What did she think I was going to do? Attack her daughter?" Yes, I thought to myself, she probably did. I had certainly not made up my mind about Ted's guilt at that fall meeting in 1975, but I wouldn't have gambled my daughter's safety on my own feelings. Ted's stance was that of an innocent man. He was hurt by the accusations, and he'd just spent 8 weeks in jail. I tried to put myself in his place, to deal with his outrage, and still, I was consumed with curiosity. But there was no way I could come right out and ask, "Ted, did you do it?
Did you do any of it? There are no rules of social etiquette for questioning an old friend accused of crimes that were so awful. He continued to toss away the Utah charges as if they were no more important than a slight misunderstanding. He was supremely confident that he would win in court in the Durant case. The burglary tools charges were too ridiculous to discuss. Things were fine with Meg. If only the police would leave them alone, allow them to enjoy this time together. She was a wonderful woman, supportive, sensitive. We sipped wine, ordered another carafe, and watched the rain run down the windows, windows in the basement restaurant that were at sidewalk level, so that we could see only the lower legs and feet of those who passed by outside. He seldom met my eyes. Instead, he sat sideways in his chair, his gaze fixed on the wall opposite. I toyed with a fresh red carnation in the vase between us, smoked too many cigarettes, as did he. I offered him some from my pack when his ran out. The tables around us were vacated, and we were finally the only people left in the room. How could I phrase it? I had to ask something. I studied Ted's profile. He looked as young as he ever had and somehow more vulnerable. Ted, I said at last, were you aware of all the girls up here who were missing last year? Had you read about it in the papers? There was a long pause. Finally, he said, that's the kind of question that bothers me. Bothers how? I couldn't read his face. He still looked away from me. Did he think I was accusing him? Was I? Or did he find it all a deadly bore? No, he continued. I was so busy going to law school at UPS, I didn't have time to read the papers. I wasn't even aware of it. I don't read that kind of news. Why wouldn't he look at me? I don't know any of the details, he said. Just things my lawyer is checking out. Of course he was lying to me. He had been teased by a lot of people about his resemblance to the Ted in the park. His own cousin, Jane Scott, had talked to him about her friend, Linda Ann Healy. Carol Ann Boone Anderson had kidded him incessantly in their offices at the Department of Emergency Services. Even if he had no personal knowledge or guilt in the cases, he did know about them. He simply didn't want to talk about them at all. He wasn't angry with me for asking. He just didn't want to discuss it. We talked of other things, old friends, the crisis clinic days, and promised to meet again before he had to go back to Utah to stand trial. When we stood outside in the rain, Ted reached out impulsively and hugged me. Then he was dashing off down First Avenue, calling back, I'll be in touch. As I walked up the hill toward my car, I felt the same emotions that would tear me up so many times. Looking at the man, listening to the man, I could not believe he was guilty. Listening to the detectives whom I also liked and trusted, I could not believe he was not. I had the distinct advantage of not being physically attracted to Ted. Any tender feelings I had for him were those of a sister for a younger brother, perhaps more compelling because I had lost my younger brother. I didn't see Ted again until Saturday, January 17, 1976. My ex-husband died suddenly, but not unexpectedly, on December 5th, and once again, family concern had blocked thoughts of Ted from my mind. I talked to him on the phone once or twice in December, and he was up, confident, anxious for the court battle that lay ahead. When he called and asked me to meet him on January 17th, I was surprised to hear from him. He said he'd suddenly wanted to see me, that he was leaving soon to go back to Salt Lake City to stand trial, and asked if I minded driving out to the Magnolia District of Seattle to meet him in a tavern there. As I drove the 25 miles, I realized that no one knew I was meeting Ted. I also knew somehow that he had lost his ever-present surveillance team. When he walked up to meet me a little after noon at the tavern that was a popular watering hole for soldiers from nearby Fort Lawton, I looked up and down the street for the sneaker cars that I had long since learned to recognize. There were none. He grinned. I lost them. They aren't as clever as they think they are. We found a table on the other side of the tavern from the shouting soldiers. I had a package under my arm, a dozen copies of magazines with my stories in them that I'd picked up from the post office. It wasn't until Ted had glanced at it several times that I realized he suspected I might have a tape recorder.
I ripped open the package and handed him a magazine. He seemed to relax. We talked for 5 hours. My memory of that long conversation is just that. It is indicative of my belief at the time in his innocence that I didn't bother to jot down notes when I got home. In many ways, it was a much more relaxed meeting than the earlier lunch. Again, we drank white wine, so much white wine for Ted at least that by the end of the afternoon he was unsteady on his feet. Because of the wine, or perhaps because we'd gotten our first meeting since his arrest over with, Ted seemed less edgy than he had been before. Considering the turns that our conversation took, this was remarkable. And yet I felt able to bring things up that might well have angered him. The din on the other side of the tavern seemed far away. No one could overhear us. A fake gas log blazed merrily in the fireplace next to our table. And as always, rain droned steadily down outside. I asked Ted at one point, "Ted, do you like women?" He considered the question and said slowly, "Yes, I think I do." "You seem to care for your mother. I guess it all goes back to that. Remember when you told me how you found out for sure that you were illegitimate, and I reminded you that your mother had always kept you with her no matter how difficult it might have been for her?" He nodded. "Yes, she did. I remember when we talked about that." He volunteered information. He told me that it had been Meg who had turned him into the police. I felt the old tug of guilt, because he didn't know that I had given them his name, too. He evidently thought I was privy to more information than I really was. "Those crutches in my room, the crutches she told them about, those were for my landlord. I used to work for a medical supply house, and I got them in the plaster of Paris there." I didn't show it, but I was surprised. I hadn't heard about the crutches or the plaster of Paris, and I certainly didn't know before this that Meg had gone to the police. Ted seemed to have no rancor at all toward Meg, who had plunged him into about as much trouble as a man can be in. His mild, forgiving stance seemed inappropriate. I wondered what Meg had told detectives about him. I wondered how he could forgive her so easily. Here he was telling me that he loved her more than he ever had, and yet, if it were not for Meg, he would not be on his way back to Utah in a few days to stand trial for kidnapping. The most he would have had to worry about were the charges of evading an officer and possession of burglary tools. I would have thought most men would have despised a woman who had done that to them. But Ted talked of the wonderful times they had had together while he was home during Christmas, their closeness, even though they were constantly followed by police. It was too mystifying for me to even question him about. It was something I would have to ponder on. I nodded agreement when he asked me to look after Meg, to see that she had someone to talk to. "She's shy. You call her, will you? Talk to her." Ted was still confident. It seemed as though the trial in Salt Lake City was more of a challenge than a threat. He was like an athlete about to enter the Olympics. He would show them. At one point during that long afternoon, I got up to go to the ladies' room, walked past tables full of half-drunk soldiers, past a couple of dozen people who hadn't seemed to recognize Ted as the infamous Ted Bundy. As I walked back to our table, suddenly someone was behind me, his hands lightly gripping my waist. I jumped, and then I heard a laugh. Ted had come up behind me so quietly that I haven't even realized he'd left the table. Later, I learned that Ted enjoyed sneaking up on women, according to Meg and Lynn Banks, that he delighted in leaping out at them from behind bushes and hearing them scream. And I remembered how he had startled me that day in the tavern. As the afternoon lengthened and it grew dark outside, the impenetrable murkiness of a January night in Seattle, I decided to tell Ted where I stood. I chose my words as carefully as possible. I was probably more honest with him about my feelings than I would ever be again. I told him about my visit to the psychiatrist, about my dilemma in being fair to him while I knew I had a book contract on the story of the missing girls. He seemed to understand completely. His manner with me was the same as it had been 5 years before when I talked about my problems in the crisis clinic offices. He assured me he could relate to my ambivalence. "And you know, I have to tell you this," I continued. "I cannot be completely convinced of your innocence." He smiled, the same flat response I was to grow used to. "That's okay. I can understand that. There are things I'd like to tell you.
but I can't.
Why?
I just can't. I asked him why he didn't just take a polygraph examination and get it over with. My lawyer, John Henry Brown, feels that it's best. It was a paradox in itself that Brown should be advising Ted. Ted hadn't been charged with anything in Washington, although he certainly was under continued surveillance, and he'd been accused by the press and most of the public. But Brown worked for the Public Defender's Office, an agency funded to defend suspects actually charged with crimes. It seemed to be a game with no rules. It wasn't usual either for a man to be convicted by the media. Ted had been asked not to use the University of Washington's Law School library anymore. It frightened women students to see him there. Ted, I said suddenly, what did you want when you called me from Salt Lake City that night in November in 1974? What night? He seemed puzzled. It was November 20th when I was in the hospital. You talked to my mother.
I never called you then.
I saw the phone records from your apartment phone in Salt Lake City. You called just before midnight.
He didn't seem upset, just stubbornly resistant.
The King County Police are lying to you.
But I saw the records.
I never called you.
I let it go. Maybe he didn't remember.
Ted bragged more about how clever he'd become at losing the men tailing him, of how he taunted them.
I know. Billy Bauman says you walked back to his car and asked him if he was with the mafia or the police, that you just wanted to be sure. Who's he?
He's a Seattle homicide detective. He's a nice guy.
I'm sure they're all princes.
Ted had talked in any depth to only one of the detectives who dogged his tracks. John Henry Brown had told him not to talk with police, that he was under no obligation to do so. But Roger Dunn had come face to face with Ted as he parked his car near a friend's apartment on December 3rd. The two men, Hunter and Hunted, had stared at each other, and Ted had asked Dunn if he had a warrant.
No, I just want to talk to you. Come on in, I'll see what I can do.
If Dunn had expected any voluntary give and take, he was disappointed. Ted had immediately gone to the phone and called Brown's office, informing an aide that Dunn was with him. Before Dunn had finished reading Ted the Miranda warning, Brown called, asked to speak to him, and told him to leave the apartment as soon as possible. He didn't want Ted talking to any Washington state officers. Ted had been more sympathetic.
I'd really like to help you out. I know the pressure on you from the press is heavy. I personally feel no pressure, but I won't talk to you now. Maybe later, John and I might get in touch with you. We'd like to eliminate you as a suspect if we could. So far, we haven't been able to.
I know there are things I know that you don't know, but I'm not at liberty to discuss them. Roger Dunn had heard much the same sentiment that Ted would repeat to me often, had also noted that Ted would not meet his eyes. And then the interview had quickly ended. Ted had held out his hand, and they shook. They had taken each other's measure. They were never to meet again. Sitting in the smoky tavern, I felt that there was more Ted wanted to say to me. It was nearing 6, and I had promised my son I'd take him to a movie that night for his birthday. Ted didn't want the visit to end. He asked me if I would go with him someplace to smoke marijuana. I demurred. I didn't use marijuana, and I had promised my son I'd be home early. And too, although I was not frightened, I may have been a little ill at ease. Ted was quite intoxicated as he hugged me outside the tavern and then disappeared into the misty rain. I would see him again, twice, after we said goodbye, but I would never see him again as a free man. Chapter 21. It is my belief that Ted's trial in Salt Lake City on the aggravated kidnapping charge involving Carol Durant was the only legal proceeding where he had everything going for him. He had chosen to leave his fate up to a judge alone and to dispense with a jury. On Monday, February 23, 1976, the trial opened in Judge Stuart Hansen's courtroom. Ted was enthusiastic about Hansen's reputation as a fair-minded jurist. He truly believed that he would walk away a free man. He had John O'Connell on his side, a veteran of 29 murder trials and considered to be one of the top attorneys in Utah. He had friends in the courtroom. Louise and Johnny Bundy, Meg, others who had flown in from Seattle, those who still believed in him from Utah.
share an hour in the friends who had convinced him to join the Mormon Church shortly before his first arrest. But Midvale Chief of Police Lewis Smith, Melissa's father, was also there, and the parents and friends of Debbie Kent and Laura Aim. There could be no charges involving their daughters, but they wanted to see what they felt to be only token justice done. In the end, the verdict would depend on the reliability of the eyewitness, Carol DeRanch, and on Ted Bundy's own testimony. O'Connell had attempted to have Sergeant Bob Hayward's testimony about Bundy's arrest on August 16th suppressed, but Hansen refused to do so. There was, of course, no mention during that first trial of the other crimes in which Ted Bundy was a prime suspect. No mention of the fact that the Volkswagen he'd sold to a teenage boy, coincidentally an ex-classmate of Melissa Smith's, on September 17, 1975, had been seized by the police and systematically ripped apart as criminalists looked for physical evidence that would tie into other cases in which Ted was suspected. Carol DeRanch was not a confident witness. She appeared to be upset by the way Ted stared steadily at her. She sobbed during her testimony, recalling her terror of 16 months before. But she pointed to Ted as he sat impassively at the defense table, identifying him positively as the man who had told her he was Officer Roseland. Ted, sitting there, clean-shaven, wearing a light gray suit, white shirt and tie, looked anything but a kidnapper. The accusing witness was plainly hysterical, buckling again and again under O'Connell's questions, questions intimating that Carol DeRanch had been led to her identification of Ted by the subtle and not-so-subtle persuasion of the detectives under Captain Pete Hayward's command. For 2 hours, the defense lawyer cross-examined the weeping girl.
You identified pretty much what law enforcement officers wanted you to, didn't you?
No, no, she replied softly.
Ted continued to stare at her implacably. When Ted himself took the stand, he admitted that he had lied to Sergeant Bob Hayward at the time of his arrest for evading an officer, that he had lied to O'Connell. He explained that he had rabbited when Hayward chased him in the patrol car on August 16th, but only because he'd been smoking marijuana. He'd wanted time to get the joint out of the car, to let the smoke clear. He admitted that he had not been to a drive-in movie, but had told Hayward that. He had not admitted the real story to John O'Connell at first. Bundy had no firm alibi for the night of November 8th, but he denied that he had ever seen Carol DeRanch before he saw her in court. The handcuffs? Only something he'd picked up at a dump and kept for a curio. He had no key for them. Assistant County Attorney David Yoakum questioned Bundy under cross-examination.
Have you ever worn a false mustache? Didn't you wear one when you were a spy in the Dan Evans campaign?
I wasn't spying for anyone, and I never wore a fake mustache during that period, Ted answered.
Didn't you brag to a woman acquaintance that you like virgins and you can have them any time?
No.
Didn't you tell that same woman that you saw no difference between right and wrong?
I don't remember that statement. If I made it, it was taken out of context and does not represent my views.
Did you ever use an old license plate on your car after you'd received new plates from the state of Utah?
No, sir. Yoakum then produced 2 gasoline credit slips.
You notified the state that you had lost plates bearing the numbers LJE379 on April 11th, 1975.
These slips show that you were still using those lost plates in the summer of 1975. Why was that? I cannot remember the incidents. The attendant probably asked for my plate numbers, and I may have inadvertently given him the old numbers from memory. Ted had lied. Not big lies, but lies, and it tainted all the rest of his testimony. He admitted that he had lied to O'Connell about the marijuana until 2 weeks before trial. A jury might have believed him. Judge Hansen did not. Hansen had retired to ponder his decision after final arguments on Friday, February 27th. On Monday, March 1st, the principals were summoned into the courtroom at 1:35 p.m., The 37-year-old judge, by his own statement, had spent an agonizing weekend, and he had found Ted Bundy guilty of aggravated kidnapping beyond a reasonable doubt. Ted, who had been free on bail, was remanded to the custody of the Salt Lake County Sheriff's Office to await sentencing. Ted was stunned. Louise Bundy's sobs were the only sound in the courtroom on that snowy afternoon. Convicted, Ted said nothing until he was handcuffed by Captain Hayward and Jerry Thompson. And then he said scornfully,
You don't need these handcuffs. I'm not going anywhere.
Meg Anders watched as Ted was led out of the courtroom, seeing it all happen. It had been what she thought she wanted when she called police with her suspicions. Now she was sorry. She wanted Ted back. Sentencing was set for March 22nd. There would, of course, be an appeal. Ted was behind bars again in a world that he hated. I wrote to him, vapid letters full of what was happening in my life, trivia. I sent him small checks through John O'Connell's office for use in the jail commissary, stationery, stamps. And still, I suspended judgment. Until I had proof that Ted was guilty of this, and perhaps of other crimes, I would wait. The frequency of his letters to me increased. They were more telling of his state of mind than what someone else could paraphrase. Some of them are misstated, as if time itself had no meaning for him any longer. Chapter 22. His first post-conviction letter was mailed on March 14, 1976, although he had mistakenly dated it February 14th.
Dear Anne, thanks for the letters and the commissary contribution. I've been slow in returning letters since this most recent setback, probably a function of my need to mentally rearrange my life, to prepare for the living hell of prison, to comprehend what the future holds for me. He said he was writing to me as a pump priming venture, to help him begin to assess what lay ahead. He was confounded by the guilty verdict and scornful of Judge Hansen, intimating that the jurist had been influenced by public opinion rather than by the evidence presented. He expected to receive a 5-to-life sentence and felt that the Department of Adult Probation and Parole were doing their pre-sentence report with bias. The report seems to be focusing on the Jekyll and Hyde theory, a thing disputed by all the psychologists who have examined me. Ted said he had heard that the probation investigator seemed to believe that Ted had made some damaging admission to me in letters. Of course, he had not. I had had only those two letters from him before the trial, and with his permission had turned them over to King County police detectives. On March 22nd, Judge Hansen announced that he would delay sentencing for 90 days, pending a psychological evaluation. Ted wrote to me that night as he crouched on the floor with his back against the steel wall of his cell, trying to glean enough light from the hall fixture so that he could see to write. He did not seem to be particularly upset about the diagnostic evaluation which would take place at the Utah State Prison at Point of the Mountain. If jail life is any indication, prison should be rich in the material that human suffering breeds, full of the startling tales which prisoners tell. For several reasons, I must take advantage of this opportunity and begin to draw upon this valuable reservoir of ideas. I will start writing. What Ted wanted from me was my editorial advice and for me to serve as his agent to help him sell the books he wanted to write about his case. He was anxious that we move rapidly in establishing our roles as collaborators and to agree on a percentage agreement on the distribution of the profits that would surely be forthcoming. He asked that I keep his proposal confidential until the time was right, and that I correspond with him through his attorney's office. I didn't know just what it was that he intended to write, but I responded with a long letter detailing the various avenues of publishing and explaining the correct manuscript form for submission. I also repeated again the information about the book contract I already had with W.W. Norton on the missing girls' cases and stressed my belief that his story would have to be a part of my book, just how much I couldn't know. I offered to share my profits with him, gauged by the number of chapters he might write in his own words. And I urged him to wait a bit with his attempts to publish, for his own protection. His legal entanglements in Utah and Colorado were not over. Colorado was moving rapidly in their investigation, although the public, of which I was a part, knew few of the details. The discovery of the credit card purchases had leaked out, however. And I had news. I was about to take a trip to Salt Lake City as part of the preparation for a travelogue book I was editing for an Oregon publishing house. I would try to get clearance to visit him in prison. That clearance would not be easy to come by. I was not a relative, and I was not on the approved list of visitors for Theodore Robert Bundy. When I called Warden Sam Smith's office in the old prison in Draper, Utah, I was told that if I called again when I arrived in Salt Lake City, they would make a decision. I was quite certain that the answer would be no.
On April 1, 1976, I flew to Utah. I had never flown in a jet, hadn't flown at all since 1954, and the speed of the flight, the knowledge that I could leave Seattle's rain and be in a comparatively balmy Salt Lake City within a few hours only added to my sense of unreality. The sun was shining, and a dusty wind blew puffs of tumbleweed over the brown landscape as I drove my rented car from the airport. I felt disoriented, much as I would 3 years later as I arrived in Miami, again because of Ted. I called the prison and learned that visitors were not usually allowed on days other than Sundays and Wednesdays. It was Thursday, and already 4 p.m. I talked to Warden Smith, who said,
"I'll have someone from the diagnostic staff call you back."
The call came. What was my purpose in wanting to visit Bundy? I'm an old friend. How long would I be in Utah? Only today and tomorrow morning. How old was I? 40? That answer seemed right. I was too old to be a Ted groupie.
Okay, we're granting you a special visit. Be at the prison at 5:15. You'll have 1 hour.
The Utah State Prison at Point of the Mountain was about 25 miles south of my motel, and I had barely enough time to find the right freeway, going in the right direction, and reach Draper, the post office stop, population 700. I looked to my right and saw the twin towers with guards armed with shotguns. The old prison and the landscape around it seemed to be all the same gray-brown color. A feeling of hopelessness seized me. I could empathize with Ted's despair at being locked up. I'd spent a summer working as a student intern at the Oregon State Training School for Girls when I was 19, and I'd carried a heavy ring of flat keys wherever I went, but that was a long time before. I'd forgotten the security needed to keep human beings behind walls and bars. The guard at the door told me I couldn't take my purse inside. "What can I do with it?" I asked. "I can't lock it in my car because my keys are in it. May I bring my keys in?"
"Sorry, nothing inside."
He finally relented and opened up a glassed-in office where I could leave my car keys after I'd locked my purse in the rental car. I carried my cigarettes in my hand.
"Sorry, no cigarettes, no matches."
I put them on a counter and waited for Ted to be brought down. I was feeling the claustrophobia I always feel in jails, even though my work may take me into almost every jail in Washington sooner or later. I felt my chest tighten, my breath catch. To get my mind off my cloistered feelings, I glanced around the waiting room. It was, of course, empty. It was not regular visiting hours. The dull walls, sagging chairs, seemed not to have changed in 50 years. There was a candy machine, a bulletin board, pictures of the staff, a leftover religious Christmas card. To whom? From whom? Disciplinary notations on prisoners. For sale notices. An application to sign up for self-defense classes. Who? The staff? The visitors? The inmates? Where would we talk? Through a glass wall via phones? Through steel mesh? Some people hate the smell of hospitals. I hate the smell of jails and prisons all the same. Stale cigarette smoke, pine sol, urine, sweat, and dust. I didn't want to see Ted in a cage. It would be too humiliating for him. A smiling man walks toward me, Lieutenant Tanner of the prison staff, and asks me to sign in. But first we move through an electric gate that clangs shut behind us heavily. I sign my name, and Lieutenant Tanner sees me through a second electric gate.
"You can talk here. You'll have an hour. They'll bring Mr. Bundy down in a few minutes."
It is a hallway, a tiny segment of space between two automatic gates on either side. There are two chairs shoved against a rack of hanging coats, and for some reason buckets of varnish beneath them. A guard sits in a glass enclosure 4 feet away. I wonder if he will be able to hear what we say. Beyond me is the prison proper, and I can hear footsteps approaching. I look away, the way one averts his eyes from someone crippled or malformed. I cannot stare at Ted in his cage. The third electric door slides open, and he is there, accompanied by two guards. They search him, pat him down. I was not searched. Had they checked me out? How did they know I had no contraband, no razor up my sleeve?
"Your ID, ma'am?"
Someone is talking to me. "It's in the car. I had to leave everything in the car."
The doors open again as I run back to retrieve my driver's license, something to prove who I am. I hand it to a guard, and he studies it, hands it back. I have not looked directly at Ted. We both wait. And now he stands in front of me. For a crazy instant, I wonder why prisoners wear T-shirts proclaiming their religious preferences. His is orange and says agnostic on the front. I look again. No, it reads diagnostic. He is very thin, wears glasses, and his hair is cut shorter than I have ever seen it. He smells of acrid sweat as he hugs me. They leave us alone to talk in this funny coat room hall. The guard behind the glass across from us appears to be disinterested, and we are interrupted only by a steady stream of people, guards, psychologists, prisoners' wives headed for an Al-Anon meeting. One of the psychologists recognizes Ted and speaks to him, shakes hands.
That's a doctor who did a psychological profile on me for John O'Connell. He told John off the record that he couldn't see how I could have done it.
Many of the people moving past us wearing civilian clothes nod and speak to Ted. It is all very civilized.
I'm in the fish tank, he explains. There are 40 of us in the diagnostic center. The judge ordered that I be held in protective custody, but I turned it down. I don't want to be isolated.
Still, he admits to a good deal of trepidation on his arrival at Point of the Mountain. He is aware that men convicted of crimes against women have a high mortality rate inside the walls.
They were lined up to see me when I arrived. I had to walk the gauntlet.
But he has found prison much better than jail.